Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm Megan LaBrice. I'm the staff writer.
And today we're going to be talking to a debut nonfiction writer. She's published a novel in the past, but her name is Kim Brooks, and the book is Small Animals. The subtitle is Parenthood in the Age of Fear.
Yeah, and we are, as graduates of NYU's Cultural Reporting and Criticism program, we are especially feeling this book, right, Clay?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's the sort of book we went to graduate school to read, really. I mean, it talks about this cultural trend, really, of sort of helicopter parenting in America, like anxious parenting, of overscheduling children and not letting them out of your sight. I mean, not letting kids walk to school on their own or walk home from school or go play a few blocks away with friends. It's sort of dark, but there's a great spirit to this book, and it's all based on, sort of started from an incident that happened to Kim Brooks when she took her children to visit their grandparents, her mother and father in Virginia, I think about 6 years ago. And it was a nice day. She had to rush inside a store, and she left her, I think at the time, maybe 4-year-old son in the car for about 5 minutes. And another person she didn't know started recording the video on her cell phone of Kim Brooks' son in the car by himself. And that person called the police.
Yeah, I have feelings about that, but...
So I think it's a book that's going to get a lot of coverage, and we are eager to talk to Kim about it. So let's call her up. So Kim, tell us a little bit about what happened in Virginia, and from that, how the idea for this book came to you.
Sure. Well, this was a while ago. It was about 6 years ago at this point. My kids at the time were 4.5 and 2. And I was visiting my parents the last day before I returned home to Chicago. I was packing up for our flight, and I realized that my son's, the special headphones that he liked to wear to watch a movie on the flight, had broken. And I decided to run to the store to get them, and he wanted to come with me instead of staying with my mom. So we went to the store, we got there, and he asked if he could wait in the car while I ran in. And it wasn't something that I sat there and thought about a lot. You know, it was kind of a quick decision. It was a pretty cool day. It was in March, so it was like probably in the upper 40s, low 50s. And I think in my mind, too, I was just thinking, you know, this was where I grew up, in a very suburban area of Virginia. And I just kind of thought, you know, I remembered all the times that my parents would run a quick errand while I would wait in the car. It wasn't something I did in Chicago because, you know, it was a city and worrying about car theft and things like that. So I said, okay. And I opened the windows. I, you know, child locked the doors. I parked right in front of the store. I ran in, was gone for about 5 minutes, got the one item, came back. He was fine. He was playing with my mom's iPad, which she had left in the car. We drove home, got my daughter, and flew home to Chicago. When I got home to Chicago, I learned that the police had shown up at my mom's house once we had left, and apparently someone had seen me do this, had seen me go in and let him wait in the car, had recorded it on their phone, had called the police, and then had waited for the police to come, and then showed them the video. And, you know, the police, even though I was gone at that point, the police then filed a report and had gone to my mom's house and were interested in charging me with a crime. So that was what happened. You know, at the time, I had no idea that I would end up writing about this. I was obviously very scared and confused and ashamed, and I didn't really understand. You know, I thought, okay, I clearly must have done something wrong, but I didn't really understand why it was wrong, you know, why I had done something dangerous or wrong that I had grown up doing all the time. So it was only over the course of, I mean, first of all, the legal consequences of this played out over about the course of a year. So there was just a long time where I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know if I was going to be charged or if I'd have to return to Virginia. By the time, and I couldn't write about anything that was happening during that period. By the time it was all over, I ended up doing 100 hours of community service and some parenting education in exchange for the prosecutor agreeing not to pursue the charge of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. So during this whole time period where the legal repercussions were playing out, I couldn't write about what had happened, but I was kind of researching it, you know, because I was trying to make sense of, you know, how had this happened? Was this something that was happening to other people, or was this just like a fluke? And what were the forces at work that were making this happen? I ended up actually, I was a writer for Salon at that point. I did a lot of writing personal essays for Salon with Sarah Hepla. And so I wrote this essay for her just about what had happened. And it wasn't sort of, the point wasn't to write it to like clear my name or defend myself. It was really kind of an exercise in like trying to pose some questions that had occurred to me in the course of this year or two that other people didn't seem to be asking very much. Questions about, you know, why parenthood has become so fearful, why we don't let kids do the kinds of things that most of us, people my age, did growing up, when the world, you know, when in fact things are safer, crime is down, things like that. What is the relationship between fear and paranoia and parenting? So I wrote the essay. It went viral. And what was really interesting about that was that not only did a lot of people read it, but suddenly a lot of people started reaching out to me saying that the same thing had happened to them. Usually women, or if not exactly the same thing, then something similar. They'd let their kid wait for a minute while they got a coffee, or they'd let their kid, you know, play in the park for a few minutes while they ran an errand, and they'd been arrested, or they'd been investigated by Child Protective Services, or they'd had to go to court. And so that was when I really thought, okay, something is going on here that people aren't talking about and writing about, you know, because of the shame and the stigma. And that was kind of, it was the other people reaching out to me. That was when I decided I wanted to expand the essay and to write a book.
Yeah, because before the idea of the book even, you write in Small Animals that you were reluctant to just talk about it, even with your most trusted, closest friends. Why was that?
Yeah. Well, I was because, you know, I had one experience where I talked about it with one friend. She was like a pretty close friend. She was like, you know, a mom friend. And I was sort of, you know, surprised by that, you know, she was very judgmental. I mean, not in an aggressive way or anything like that, but she was immediately like, well, I would never have done that. You know, what were you thinking? It was like that kind of reaction. And so I quickly realized that, you know, and that it was almost sort of like, you know, like I've learned not to debate like vaccine issues with people who don't believe in vaccinating their kids because it's like, it doesn't matter how many statistics I give them or like reasoning. It's like, they're not going to see things from the way I see them. And that was what I came up against, was that the couple people I would try to talk about it with, not everybody, a lot of people were very supportive and were like, this seems insane. But a couple people were just like, well, that just doesn't seem safe. And it didn't matter, you know, you could say, well, but it, you know, the most dangerous thing I did statistically was actually getting in the car and driving with my kid. You know, hundreds of kids die or injured in car accidents every single day. That's much more dangerous. Whereas it would take, I think the statistic is, it would take 750,000 years for a kid waiting by himself to be abducted by a stranger, for example, from a parking lot. But like, it was like that kind of reasoning. They would just be like, well, but it just doesn't feel safe. That just doesn't seem safe. And so I realized that there was some kind of irrationality around a lot of these fears that we have with kids. And so, you know, it's hard to sort of, nobody wants to be judged or to alienate their friends. So it wasn't that I didn't talk about it with anyone, but I sort of quickly learned that I had to be, normally I talk about everything with everybody, like, My husband once asked me, "Have you ever not told anyone anything?" I don't know. but I kind of learned with this, like, I can't really talk to everybody about it. And now, of course, I've written a book, so I'll talk about it nonstop for several months.
Right.
At the time, I was a little more cautious.
It's difficult to write in detail about cultural sort of, I guess, expectations that seem so ingrained in us that they seem to just kind of be in the air. I mean, everyone expects nowadays that parents, you know, overschedule their kids and are sort of hovering over them all the time. In the book, though, I mean, one thing I really like about it is that you achieve the task of making us see that what we think is normal isn't actually normal. But I wondered if writing this book at the beginning must have felt a little daunting to you to wrestle with such a vast topic.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt daunting. You know, it was my first book of nonfiction. You know, in terms of just the size of the project, I was lucky because I had an amazing editor, Whitney Frick, and then later Bryn Clark, and they both were so good at, like, helping me break it down into the different, you know, parts of the story that I wanted to tell and kind of melding the, you know, my personal story with my research and my reporting. I think that that's an interesting point, though, in terms of it being sort of something that's in the air, that's hard to sort of dissect in a rigorous or rational way. One thing that helped a lot that was sort of a breakthrough moment for me, I think, in my thinking was I saw this research that this woman named Barbara Czarnecka had done at UC Irvine, and I ended up talking to her a lot for the book and writing about her research. And she had done this research about the link between risk assessment and moral judgment. And what she had found was that she does this experiment, and I kind of go into the whole thing in the book, but she basically gave participants in this study different scenarios where a kid was left alone for a few minutes in a car, like in a cool garage, and then manipulated the reason the parent had left them. So in one scenario, it would be by accident that the parent was, you know, struck by a car unconscious for 10 minutes or something. And in another scenario, it would be like the parent had to run into work, or, you know, in another scenario, the parent went to meet a lover for a few minutes or something like that. And so she was expecting, you know, of course, people's moral judgment or moral condemnation would vary depending on the reason, and that was true. But her results that she didn't expect, which were so fascinating to me and really were sort of one of the engines behind the book, was that not only did people's moral judgment change, but their assessment of the danger that the child was in, their risk assessment changed, which makes no sense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if a child is left alone in a place for 10 minutes, they're not in more danger if the mom is running into work or if she was accidentally, you know, struck by a car unconscious for 10 minutes. The situation is the same. But in this study, they found that people think the child is in more danger if there's more moral condemnation around the reason the parents. So that was very important for me because it kind of like was a key that unlocked this idea that a lot of our risk assessment about children, when we say that, you know, what that parent's doing doesn't seem safe, or I would never do that, or, you know, what kind of parent would take any chance? We think that we're talking about protecting children or about child safety, but often what people are really talking about is moral judgment. And that
right.
It's sort of the more judgmental we are, the riskier these things seem, and it sort of forms a feedback loop.
And with that particular study, wasn't there, in fact, a differential between judgments of mothers and judgments of fathers?
Yeah, the difference for that, I thought, and this was, I thought, fascinating, was the major difference was when women were running into work, that was judged with the same sort of condemnation, like as if they were doing something for fun, you know, like going to say hi to a friend or going shopping. Whereas when a man was left the child to run into work, it was seen as something essential that he had to do along, you know. So we were more, there was more condemnation around women who left a child for a few minutes to go into work. And thus it seemed riskier than it did when a man did it, which is infuriating.
It's infuriating, but it's also fascinating. And it really got me thinking, you know, like, because one of the questions this book asks is, what's the price of fear? Who pays for it? You know, and in mothers versus fathers, like I think of, you know, the term bad mother. That's something that's a cliche, bad mother. And then I was like, you don't hear like bad father. But one thing you do hear is deadbeat dad. And as long as it seems like in that condemnation, as long as the father is present as a financial provider, you know, as long as they're financially supporting the offspring, it doesn't really matter how frequently they're available or proximity to the child.
It's sad, but true. Yes. I mean, right. I'll often joke with people, you know, like I'll say, I think I'm like a B mom, you know, like a B or a B plus. But I would be an A plus dad. Like I would be an amazing dad, you know? That's a strain that runs all through the book, and it's just something I think about constantly. I constantly wonder what these parenting norms would look like, and the culture of parenthood would look like if men were the ones doing the majority of the child care and bearing the brunt of the burden of child care. And, you know, I just think that we need to acknowledge that we still seem to have a tremendous amount of ambivalence about mothers working outside the home in this country, which is, it sounds incredible to say it because it's like, but it's 2018, like, right, really? It's not, you know, 1958. But I mean, it seems like it's impossible to deny at this point. You know, in the course of doing this research, like, I realized, I mean, I guess I kind of knew all these things without knowing them concretely. But, you know, you look at the fact that we're one of the few countries with no universal subsidized daycare, no mandatory paid family leave for men and women, you know, no guarantee of, like, early childhood, quality early child education, all these other things that other countries do to support mothers and parents, you know, and to operate under the assumption that a lot of women will want to work outside the home and we should support them so that they can do that. We just don't do those things.
You know, I was so glad that you quoted this writer whose name is Judith Warner. And she used to live in France and then returned to America. And she writes in her book, Perfect Madness, that she never met a French mother whose life was, you know, overrun by her children. And she writes, quote, only an unbalanced person would be doing something like that, a woman who was perhaps fearful of adulthood. You know, you looked at other countries' parenting cultures to write this book. Do you have ideas about why this, you know, anxious parenting is an American phenomenon?
Yeah, I have a few ideas. I mean, gosh, where to start? I mean, you know, I think a big part of it, honestly, and I should just say, you know, I love that quote, too, from Judith Warner. Now that I hear it back, though, I feel like since I wrote that, like, I've softened a little, and I feel like it's a little bit, it's like she's being a little bit hard on the American mothers who are like that, because even though I completely know what she's talking about, what she's observing there, it's like I know a lot of women like this, and in some ways I have been one, and it's like in a way, the way things are set up structurally, we're really not left with much of a choice. You know, I mean, the recent statistic I read was that, you know, I mean, in France, they have free daycare. You know, like it's a lot easier to have a balanced life and to read books and to have a career and to have adult relationships when, you know, you're not individually expected to have your eyes on your child every second and be responsible for them for their every need from the time they're born till they're 22 years old. You know, I think the cost now of daycare for an infant, the average cost nationally is $17,000 a year. Jesus. The average national cost of daycare for a four-year-old is $14,000 a year. So if you are a working woman and you have, you know, you want to have two kids, you know, you have a four-year-old and an infant, you're talking about paying over $30,000 a year on average just to have them in daycare. So that's like before they even start school. So I think what happens is a lot of women, you know, who aren't wealthy say, well, it's not worth it. You know, I'm not going to, why would I go and work full time and never see my kids? And, you know, a lot of jobs don't offer much flexibility, you know, and then pay 70 or 80% or 90% of my income to daycare. And so then the burden falls completely on the individual mother, the individual father. And that certainly kind of doesn't support a balanced life. You know, and then in terms of just like the culture though of like paranoia and nervousness and like the competitiveness, I think that there is also just something about, you know, I don't know, American individualism and the focus on like getting ahead, you know, competing with everyone, you know, the individual is responsible for everything that kind of drives people insane. There's this quote from Bill Dershowitz's book, Excellent Sheep, which I love, where he says, I might misquote it a little bit, but it's something like, at some point, the only thing driving the madness is the madness itself. Everyone else is doing this, it starts to seem normal, and so you start doing it too.
And it's interesting that it's not generally a directly acknowledged competition between parents. It's more of, it's less spoken than that. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's often subtle. Or I have a friend who was saying how like the thing that drove her nuts was whenever she would pick her kids up at school, she'd call it carpool lane boasting. And it was just like everyone would be like, so, you know, what after schools is Jimmy doing this year? Like what extracurriculars is Katie doing? And like she said they'd sort of ask it in this way where, you know, it was as though they were just trying to get information, but she felt it was very clear. It was about like, let me tell you about all the things my kid is doing. And then she was always like, she was like, my kids like to come home after school and watch TV for an hour and a half. They really enjoy that. She's like, well, I like buy stuff on Etsy or like talk to my friend in Tucson or something. She's like, but that's not like a celebrated choice. That's not, you know, but mm-hmm. I always encouraged her to go ahead and share that nonetheless.
So I want to ask you, I mean, the anxious parenting you write about obviously extends to, you know, American society at large. And you've got this interesting quote from an occupational therapist in Chicago who treats children. And she said to you that, quote, everyone's in their own little pod and there's this constant judgment of one another in America. I know this is kind of a tall order, but having done all this research for the book, do you have any ideas about how we could make American parenting a less fraught endeavor for parents and for kids?
Yeah. Well, socialism. that would be the short answer. You know, electing some good socialists, feminist socialists, that would be number one.
Okay.
Beyond that, on a personal level, I think, you know, things like, I mean, I think the big thing is broadening the scope of parenthood, broadening our sense of who is responsible for children from mom and dad or whoever, you know, one or two parents, to the idea that maybe we're responsible for like all kids, you know, that maybe parenthood can be a more communal endeavor instead of something that's really just focused on the nuclear family. You know, so I think it has to do with changing our sensibility. I think it, to give you something concrete, like, I think it's important for kids to learn to talk to strangers. You know, I grew up in the 80s when this whole, like, don't never talk to strangers campaign started, which is kind of terrible to live in a world where you can't talk to strangers. I think, like, studies show that it's actually, like, good for your mental health to have conversations with strangers. But kind of changing our expectations from this idea that one or two people can provide a child with everything they need in terms of guidance, mentorship, nurturing, you know, friendship, to like maybe kids need lots of adults supporting them and encouraging them in different ways, you know. And so it's, I think it really, there has to be like an entire shift in our mindset of who is responsible for raising children.
Yeah, because very few strangers are kidnappers.
Very few strangers are kidnappers. It's really true. And we've like forgotten that. And it's, there's a whole history of why that is. I get into it a little bit in the book. There's a really great book, if people are interested in that specific question, called Threatened Children by Joel Beth, sociologist. And he kind of goes into that whole thing. Like, how did we get to that place? Also, Charles Beck, I think, has a great book called We Believe the Children.
Mm-hmm.
It's all Reagan's fault, basically. I don't know. It's the 80s. Like, Reagan and the suburb, Reagan and suburbanization, fear of the other, fear of the stranger.
Yeah. It's no wonder Stranger Things is so popular.
Yeah, exactly, right?
So, Kim, we can't let you go until you talk a little bit, even if just briefly, about this company named Cognition Builders, which was certainly eye-opening to me. I had never heard of anything like this, and I think it was eye-opening to you. Can you talk a little bit about what that company does and your reactions to it? Because you had both positive and negative feelings about it, right?
Yeah. So that Cognition Builders is a company that I wrote about for New York Magazine, and basically what they do is they cater to the super wealthy, and they provided different types of services. But basically, what they do is they come into a family's home and they set up cameras, like, so that they can observe what the family is doing, how the parents are parenting, what a kid is doing, and sort of help parents through real-time interventions parent better or set up structures or set up discipline in the home. And then they offer, like, a lot of feedback. They offer, like, pages and pages of emails sort of describing progress and setbacks. So for a very, very large fee, it's sort of like, my take on it was, it's sort of the way, like, if you ran a business or a company that was failing or having problems, people would hire to have a consultant come in, right? And that's sort of what they do. They're like a consultant for your kid or for your family life. And yeah, I mean, I found it scary and strange and fascinating. And, you know, I say in the book, like, there was a part of me as I was, like, observing them and learning about them that thought, oh, yeah, like, if I had $1 gajillion, I would do this, you know? Like, I want to figure out how to get my kids not to, like, be fighting and killing each other, you know, the second they get home from school, and, all, you know, all the things that we struggle with as parents. Like, there are so many moments where I'm parenting my kids and I'm like, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know what the best thing to do is here. I really don't. And I don't have, like, 3 hours to say, let's pause, kids, and let me go do a little bit of research, right? You just, you make it up, and then, you know, you hope for the best. And if it's a disaster, maybe you try to do it differently next time. There was a part of me that thought, wow, I can see how that would be tempting to have, like, an expert kind of watching you and giving you input. At the same time, I mean, I thought it was absurd. I mean, completely ridiculous, right? That, and one more way in which, like, we've taken something that should really be about a relationship, an intimate relationship, right? I mean, that's what I think parenting is. It's just a relationship. And I shouldn't say just, because I think relationships are extremely important to human happiness. But we've taken something that should be a relationship and made it into, like, a business or a project or, like, a thing that we can do and control and manipulate to get, like, the outcome that we want. And, you know, if you have enough money, you can do that.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that that's particularly healthy for kids or parents or society to take relationships and turn them into businesses.
Yeah. Well, Kim, this book has the rare power of, you know, setting down in words and articulating something that I think all of us have wondered about. And that's very difficult to do. And you did a great job. The book is Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. And thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
If you're on the hunt for a sports podcast to go along with Fully Booked that will expand your mind, then check out Revenge of the Jocks with Martellus Bennett, new to Podcast One. Join Super Bowl champ Martellus Bennett as he covers a broad spectrum of what it means to be a creative, to be an activist, and an overall culture-shaping world changer. He's no one-trick pony. Listen free to Revenge of the Jocks with Martellus Bennett each week, exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app. If you love the show, share it with a friend and leave a rating and review. We'd really appreciate it. Let's be honest here. Most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes. Also, Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. With Quip's subscription plans, they're focused on your health. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. And check this out. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. Quip starts at just $25, and for all you Fully Booked listeners, if you go to getquip.com/Kirkus right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. Again, that's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/Kirkus. GETQUIP.com/Kirkus. Do it for your teeth.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
One of the amazing things about that book, Megan, I think, is that neither you or I are parents, and we both really got into it.
Oh, it was riveting. And I think it just says it has so many implications for us as a society, you know, without...
Yeah, that's what I love. I mean, it's sort of sold as a parenting book, but she's really talking about American society at large and fear in our society as a whole, you know?
Yeah, fear and exceptionalism and consumerism and misogyny, and it's a cornucopia of delights, Clay.
That's right. So this is one of, we think, is going to be a big book for the fall. Mm-hmm. It'll be out today, actually, August 21st, and we think it's going to get a lot of coverage, maybe even some controversial coverage. But we just published on August 15th, we just published our fall preview. And for those of you who don't subscribe to Kirkus Reviews, that's the issue every year where we sort of put a highlight, like spotlight on the big books of the fall. And Megan, you interviewed some writers for that issue, didn't you?
I sure did, Clay. Yeah. I had the privilege of interviewing Khaled Hosseini. Of course, he wrote The Kite Runner and those other two tremendous million mega-selling books, novels. This is his fourth book. It's a short book, and it is illustrated by a London-based artist named Dan Williams. And it's called Sea Prayer. It's this short, lyrical, affecting story. It's kind of like a father's inner monologue directed toward his sleeping son on an unnamed beach at night, and they're refugees. They're about to attempt an escape by raft across the sea. And it's the father's thoughts, thinking of the memories he has of his town in Syria, thinking of the memories his young son has, which are, of course, you know, that same city in times of war. This is a book for all ages, definitely.
So what was the book inspired by, that famous photo that went viral of that poor little boy who died on a beach as a refugee?
Yeah, that's correct. Alan Kurdi, 3 years old. I think many of us have seen the photographs of his body in the sand on the beach, and then he's picked up by a relief worker. Mm-hmm. And it broke Khaled Hosseini's heart. he said. And he saw it through the eyes of a father. He has two children of his own. And he wondered, what would it be like to be the father of that boy? Yeah. And this book is the result.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed Doris Kearns Goodwin for the fall preview. Yeah. So she has of course, everybody knows her from Team of Rivals, the book about Lincoln's cabinet and how he chose the members of that cabinet. And she won the Pulitzer before then. You know, really one of the best known American historians there is. But her new book is titled Leadership in Turbulent Times. And she does these great little profiles of Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and LBJ.
Yeah.
And talking about sort of how they came to understand that they were leaders and how they got other people to believe in their vision, given all the turbulence in the current administration. This book is perfectly timed. I mean, so of course I asked her, did you start writing this after Trump was nominated as the Republican candidate? And she said no, that she started writing it 5 years ago, actually when Obama was, you know, when Democrats and Republicans weren't talking to each other at that time too. So
yeah,
things have just gotten more intense in that regard, but it's just a perfectly timed book. So, but anyway, we've got interviews with 12 writers who are going to have big books out this fall. And we encourage you, if you don't subscribe, check out our website to see those interviews. So our editors have some big ideas about which books they think you ought to be paying attention to. So let's call them up and see what they have to say.
Let's do it.
All right, we've got our senior editors on the line. We've got Vicki Smith. She is our children's editor. Laura Simeon is our young adult book editor. Eric Liebetrau is our nonfiction editor. And Laurie Muchnick is our fiction editor. Vicki, what is really hot in children's books this week?
Well, a book that I am super excited about, and I think that a lot of people are going to be excited about, is called Little Man, Little Man by James Baldwin, with illustrators by Joran Kazak. And this is, in fact, the James Baldwin. And he wrote the book in the 70s, and it was published, but it just kind of didn't really go anywhere. Julius Lester gave it a very dismissive review, which seems kind of ironic. But it's been brought back into print by Duke University Press, and it comes with a fair amount of additional material. There's a foreword by Tejan Karefa Smart and an afterword by Aisha Karefa Smart. And those are two of Baldwin's relatives, the nephew and niece, who actually figure as characters in the book. And the backstory for the book is that when Baldwin visited his young relatives, there was, you know, theirs was a household that was very conscious of the importance of Black stories and Black storytelling to counteract all the white stories that the children were getting at school and in the public library. And his little nephew kept saying, "Uncle Jimmy, Uncle Jimmy, when are you going to write a book about me?" And so he did. Awesome. And it is not as adorable as that sound. I mean, the scenario is adorable, but the actual book is, it's really, it's elliptical. It's interesting. It gives child readers a lot of gaps to sort of imagine what's happening in the story. It's all filtered through the perspective of four-year-old TJ, and he's a really observant kid, but he doesn't necessarily understand what he is reporting on. Mm-hmm. It's all done in this great vernacular that I'm not going to try to read aloud because I can't. But it's this really warm depiction of a neighborhood. It's sort of like a story that kids who've read Last Stop on Market Street might read in a couple of years, that is just as embedded in sort of celebrating a community that is complicated and rich. It's very neat. Our reviewer felt that in the situations that it discusses, it's just as relevant now as it was 40 years ago when it was first published. So I think everybody should be excited that it's back in print.
Yeah, I'm very excited. This is a book that I read years ago, actually, and had forgotten about. But it's good to see it coming back out. My son's a little too young for it now, but I'd like to introduce it to him in a couple years. Do you think this is a good entry point for Baldwin for young readers?
Well, it's really the only entry point for Baldwin for young readers.
Yeah.
So yes. I mean, it's so conscious of its own culture and I don't want to say insular nature of the culture, but it doesn't depend on anything else. It is, our reviewer said, it's a celebration of Black life, which it is. And so I think that in that way, it really is a good introduction to Baldwin. You can certainly, you know, the adult who has read other Baldwin can see themes from it that TJ doesn't understand, and maybe young children wouldn't understand, but they're going to take root and become more apparent as they are, as they get older and read grown-up Baldwin.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
Sure.
Turning now to YA, Laura, what do you have for us?
Well, there's a new book out this week. It's Ariel Kaplan's second, and both of her books have gotten Kirkus stars. This one is called We Regret to Inform You, and it's about a D.C. area private school senior named Misha, and she has a single mom who sacrificed everything so she can go to the school and get the best education possible. She's, you know, her grandmother survived, you know, fled the Nazis. Fled Eastern Europe, and always felt like because she managed to live, she was obligated to do something with her life. And so this kind of spirit, you know, is in her family, like you make the most of every opportunity. So she's worked so hard. She's a brilliant student. And then she's rejected by every single college that she's applied to, including her safety school.
Ouch.
Yes. So she teams up with these girl hackers at her high school who work out that somebody tampered with her transcript and recommendation letters. And the question is who? And so that's really the central part of the story. And it's wonderfully written. Misha just has this very fresh, real voice. But it's more than just this high school drama. It's also, it's really kind of examining this idea that's out there that, you know, where you go to college matters more than anything else, that it's worth sacrificing everything to, that's going to determine the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that I think it's people sometimes don't question. It's easy to get caught up in this sort of race to get into the best school possible, however you define best. It also really highlights how many high school students kind of spend those years prepping to be a good college applicant instead of, you know.
Yeah. And how their parents direct. This is so exciting, like as a recommendation for this specific podcast, because for our lead interview, we had Kim Brooks, who wrote Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear.
Oh, I'm dying to read that.
Oh my God, I can't wait. I can't wait to talk about it with you. But it's real. This is great. You put a smile on my face. Thank you.
Okay.
Laura, I was wondering, you know, how broadly this applies. Like, is this book only going to appeal to kids at sort of fancy urban private schools, like the kids in the book?
You know, that's a good question. So on the one hand, Misha's mom says, look, you know, and Misha herself says this, in the real world, nobody thinks I'm poor and underprivileged. You know, I seem that way at my school where I'm the scholarship kid, but in real life, I know I'm not. On the other hand, I don't know if you've seen the documentary Race to Nowhere. You know, that talks about how this kind of college admissions race affects kids across the socioeconomic spectrum, because it's that whole inflation around how many extracurriculars you do and so on, and how it's, I think it probably will speak more to kids who identify with Misha or go to a similar kind of school. But I think that general for kids who are thinking of going to college and kids who aren't and who are thinking about, well, how much do people value my life path and how much respect do I get for the choice I'm making, whatever that might be. Partly the author really captures the teenage voice very well. It's just beautifully written on top of everything else. So I would say, you know, give it a shot even if you're not sure.
So Eric, what are we liking in nonfiction?
Well, I think this is a good follow-up to Vicky's choice, because the book by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me, has made it back onto the bestseller list, which I'm very happy to see. This is a Kirkus Prize winner a few years ago, and he's very much a kindred spirit to Baldwin. Baldwin was also one of his biggest influences. This was his second book. He's gone on to write a couple more. He's won a ton of awards. This one is probably one of the most eloquent, hard-hitting books about race in America of the past decade. It talks about growing up in West Baltimore and then how his life changed when he attended Howard University, which, as he writes, had always been one of the most critical gathering posts for Black people. He called it the Mecca throughout.
And for those who haven't read this, I would highly recommend it, and I'm very happy to see it back on the bestseller list. It's certainly just as important and just as relevant now as it was 3 years ago.
So, Eric, this fall we have young reader editions of Carol Anderson's White Rage and also Brian Stevenson's Just Mercy. And it dawned on me that we don't yet have a young reader's edition of this Ta-Nehisi Coates books. Do you think it would do well as an adaptation?
I do. I'm excited to hear that those books are going to be adapted. And I do think it could be done. I think it would take just the right adapter. But I also wanted to ask you, how do you think these young reader editions of these kind of seminal books, are they often well done?
I think so. I feel like they're done in a very mindful way that would even appeal maybe to an adult reader who thinks, so I don't have time to read the whole thing. Like they distill it down to the essence and maybe take out some of the edgier content.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say, this one is already pretty distilled. There's really not a lot of room for kind of further bringing it down, but I think, or distilling it down. But I think in the right context, it could be done.
My 15-year-old brought this book to sleepaway camp with him because, you know, it doesn't exactly seem like summer reading, but he chose to read it as his sort of summer book for his English class at school next year. And when I went to see him at visiting day, he was telling me that his counselor borrowed it and then a bunch of other people wanted to borrow it. So I'm not sure it needs a, you know, young adult edition. It sounds like a bunch of teenagers are clamoring for it at the moment.
Yeah, I think that age, it is appropriate. I'm not sure how far down they go in ages for these younger reader editions, but I'm glad to hear that your son chose that book.
Well, don't go anywhere, Lori. What's your fiction pick this week?
My pick is Clock Dance by Anne Tyler.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's always nice to have a new one from her. It's been a few years since she wrote a novel. Tyler's books are always really wonderful examinations of quirky families and neighborhoods, groups of people. This one focuses on a woman named Willa. It starts when she's an 11-year-old girl, and first half of the book kind of peeks in at her at three different times in her life. Once when she's 11 and her mother just sort of disappears for a few days, and she's left behind to try to help her younger sister and her father cope. Her father, who clearly is so in love with his wife, who he calls tempestuous, even though she to just walk out and disappear for a few days at a time, which is, I think, a not uncommon Tyler type. And then we come back. So that's in 1967. Then we come back in 77 when Willa's in college and she's bringing home her boyfriend who really wants, he's a senior and she's a junior, and he wants to marry her right away so she can move across country with him, but she doesn't want to. And there's sort of a, you know, clash between him and her parents, and she goes off and marries him at the end because, you know, I think dealing with her own parents' relationship, she's turned into sort of a placator, someone who's just always trying to make everybody happy. Check in with her again 20 years later, and I don't think this is a spoiler at all, but, you know, within about three pages, her husband dies in a car accident of completely his own fault because of road rage. And
oh, God.
And you see her sort of continuing to be a placator and dealing with her sons and various other people and learning how to live on her own. And then it skips ahead to 2017, another 20 years where she's remarried. And this is the bulk of the book, sort of the second half of the book. She gets a phone call one day, and it's from some woman who she's never heard of. And it turns out that one of her sons had been living in Baltimore with a woman who he wasn't married to, who had a 9-year-old daughter. And Willa had never met the girl or her mother. And her son had actually moved out. He was no longer living with this woman. But it turns out that this woman, Denise, was shot in the leg. And one of her neighbors just found Willa's phone number on the wall and thought that she was Denise's daughter's grandmother and said, can you come take care of this girl while her mother's in the hospital? And Willa never managed to get out the fact that she was no relation to the little girl. He just flew to, because she's such a sort of placator, she flies to take care of this girl. And, you know, and then is just sort of dropped into this wonderful Anne Tyler scene with, you know, quirky neighbors, and her new husband has gone with her. And he is just another kind of annoying, you know, kind of controlling man. And you just think she has the worst taste in men and this kind of unusual thing that she's done, fly to Baltimore to take care of this kid. Is this going to sort of break her out and help her come into her own? And it's really quite, you know, beautifully written and observed and just so much fun to read.
It's interesting, Lori, that this is the second book that we're talking about today that has a real strong connection to Baltimore. But it seems like it couldn't be much more different from Between the World and Me. Do you have any sense of how its Baltimore is developed?
I think in general, Tyler's Baltimore does tend to be a more upper middle class white Baltimore. This is a little bit more of a working class neighborhood. It's mostly white, but there is some diversity. The neighbor, you learn a lot about different neighbors. One of the houses down the block, the Cheryl, who's the 9-year-old, whenever she passes by, she says, that's where these two men live. I can't remember their names. They're gay, but that's okay. And but that's okay is all written in hyphens. You can tell, like, that's how her mother always puts it. They're gay, but that's okay. There is a sort of diversity and lots of different people living on this kind of working class block in Baltimore. And you do get a lot of, as they walk the dog, Tyler runs down all the different businesses that they walk past and the different neighbors that they see, and you get a real feeling for the place.
Cool.
Thank you all. Those are some great picks. We hope you join us next week. We're going to be talking to Randy Kennedy. He was an art critic for the New York Times for a number of years, and he is now a debut novelist. His novel Presidio is about two estranged brothers and an unexpected passenger who embark on a road trip through Texas to recover some stolen money. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hey, podcast listeners, this is Stevie and Suzanne Hendricks.
Woo! We are excited to announce the launch of our new podcast, The Good Life with Stevie and Suzanne, right here on Podcast One.
We're here to warm hearts, inspire minds, and captivate you with powerful conversations with people from major celebrities to everyday people who are making an impact.
You'll laugh, cry, and take part in a community that will motivate you to live a good life.
Check out The Good Life with Stevie and Suzanne starting this July at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts.
Yay! And don't forget to rate and review us. See you then.